Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600. And thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks. Majority Leader of the Connecticut Senate, Senator Bob Duff, is here this morning. Senator Duff, thanks for coming on. Good to have you here. How are you?
Great. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, of course. We'd love to have you on more often. We've been talking a lot about the public option for health insurance. I think both sides of the aisle completely agree. Health insurance is crazy expensive. Everyone agrees that we need to find a better solution. But is the public health option the best solution? I have a few questions. I know we've heard from the other side. We've heard where people are opposed, especially from brokers and some of the Republican leaders. But I wanted to hear from you this morning. First of all, there are questions about customer experience and how it's going to be handled. It seems like reading through the bill, it's kind of alluding to having the exchange or state government manage those calls. And we're already understaffed. And I'm just curious, like, are these representatives, first of all, do they exist? And are they fully educated to talk about things like claims or pharmacy issues that are definitely going to arise every time people sign up for health insurance?
Right. Well, thanks for having me on this morning. You know, just on the baseline here, healthcare remains one of the most important issues for us nationally and here in the state. Affordable health care is something that we strive to work for each and every day as the Democratic Party and as in the legislature. And that I believe that, you know, we can come up with a plan that will be affordable and accessible and continue to provide good health care for folks. You know, the mechanics of all of this, of the public option, will continue to get worked out as the legislative session progresses along. But I don't think anybody would believe that this would just be some sort of a state-run program that would not, in fact, bring in the insurers, the insurance companies that we have already in the state of Connecticut. What this does is it allows small businesses and individuals, others, to have the ability to buy into a system where they would be able to then be part of a larger group, a larger network that would allow them to purchase insurance at a cheaper rate. So this would provide that insurance that is more affordable. And, you know, I don't think we're going to, the state of Connecticut is going to offer some insurance and set up a system that is in competition with one of our insurance companies. I think, in fact, what we'll do is we'll say we now have 200,000 people on this plan who've signed up for this public option, put an RFP out, and then say, okay, come in and give us your best prices for that. So where an individual would never have that ability to leverage that themselves, so if they're part of a larger group, they're able to then do it like any other large company can.
Mm-hmm. So would brokers be included in being able to roll out the public option?
Well, we'll have to see, you know, how it all ends up working out, and we want to make sure that whatever we do, it ends up being in the benefit of the consumer, and that we're giving them and providing them with the cheapest cost with the best health care coverage that we can. So I think, however it works out in the end, that it's a way in which we can provide that option, but do it in a way that is the cheapest. So if that's through brokers, if that's through other means, you know, we should do it. We have Access Health, which is part of the Affordable Care Act. And
right.
That has, you know, Connecticut has been praised nationally. We've been modeled by other states on how well we have rolled that out. And so I think what we'll try and do is something similar in a way that will also provide access to health care, but do it in an affordable way.
Now, what about coverage? I know you kind of touched on that a little bit. Do we have any clarity, like, on the specifics? Is this one plan under the public health option? Are these multiple plans? Is it only for in-state networks? Is it for outside of Connecticut? Like, we have some people who would prefer to go to a New York hospital for their cancer treatments, for example. Like, would the public health option, would that allow them to do that?
Yeah, I think the details of all those things will get worked out, and depends on how you structure any kind of a program and what kind of response you get from the marketplace. I think the marketplace, if they know that they have the ability to cover a large group of people and do it in a way that's more efficient, I think that we'll get a good response back from the marketplace. And so that will determine on how well this goes. And maybe in the beginning you start small and you gradually expand. We've also seen that with the partnership plan that we have with our boards of ed and our municipalities that are buying into the Connecticut healthcare system. Municipalities all across the state of Connecticut have saved a lot of money by buying into our healthcare plan, and that has saved local taxpayers probably tens of millions of dollars, not hundreds of millions of dollars. And the people, for the most part, that I hear, the people who are on those plans, municipal employees, board of ed employees, have all said that they view this as a very, very good plan. So there's ways in which we can leverage more people on a healthcare plan, and that actually saves money and gives better results. And that's exactly what we're looking for.
Senator Bob Duff is here this morning. We're talking about the public health option, a bill that's gotten a lot of your feedback, and we want to talk a little bit more about some of the gaps that we're seeing in the bill right now, which it sounds like they're still getting worked out. Senator Duff, am I correct in that the bill as is, the 35-page bill, that wouldn't pass as is right now?
Well, again, there's public hearings. There still needs work to be done. Obviously, there's a lot of details that need to go in. There's a lot of people who, want a seat at the table. We want to make sure we're listening to. We want to still make sure we have a good product at the end, and we still have to get the votes.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of pieces there. But I think in the end, again, we want to keep our eye on the ball, which is, I hear from a lot of people who are independent contractors, small businesses, folks who normally have such a hard time getting health insurance because they're over the income limits for Affordable Care Act, but they don't have that kind of scale as a large company does.
No question.
They're kind of really stuck in the middle.
Yeah.
And there really hasn't been good options for them to be able to get affordable health care without these kind of crazy high deductible plans. And so nobody should have to, have a $5,000 or $10,000 high deductible plan because then they're not taking care of themselves or their family. So, looking for ways in which we can provide that affordable health care that brings it on scale with some large companies. I think that really is what we're trying to do so that everybody has access to good quality health care as they should.
No question. I mean, unfortunately, I think Connecticut, much like so many other states, has seen, unfortunately, the trickle effect. And we've even had our national leaders like Senator Blumenthal who came on and said, look, the Obamacare is broken, unfortunately. And we have people in Fairfield County alone, which I know Senator Duff, because that's part of your district. We have people who in the last 6 years have seen a 200% increase in their health insurance costs. And it's crazy. It's absolutely unlivable. So you're absolutely right. Now, just before I let you go, Senator, I was curious, there's a concern with financials in Connecticut because we're already in the red at this point. What about potential claims leading to further state debt? Like, how do we ensure that this public option is not going to lead to a tax hike for people?
Right. Well, I would just so on one thing, we don't forget we have our largest rainy day fund ever, and we were projected to have surpluses prior to COVID, and we're actually projected to have a small surplus this fiscal year, and we'll see what happens over the next 2 years when when the tax revenue comes in by April 15th or so. So all is not lost, but I understand your point about finances on this. I think the public option is going to have to be, in my opinion, self-sustaining, and it's going to now there may be an initial investment in that, but from a standpoint of how it works, it's going to have to be able to stand on its own 2 feet, and we're going to have to make sure that we're working this so that it is affordable, yet it is something that can be sustaining so that we're not trying to rob Peter to pay Paul on this, but we've got to be smart about how we approach this whole thing. But I would say Connecticut is one of the best states around right now that from an economic standpoint, we have the largest rainy day fund. We have good financials right now. We have saved money. We're paying down our long-term debt. We have the smallest amount of state employees per capita since the mid-1950s, and we have cut billions of dollars of discretionary funds. So we have really worked hard to right-size the budget. Unfortunately, we have a pandemic thrown in here, but we are going to make sure that we keep people of the state of Connecticut healthy and safe, and that is really what the job is for government.
Senator Bob Duff, Majority Leader of the Connecticut Senate, thank you so much for coming on. I'd love to have you on more often. It's very helpful to talk to you. Thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. Just keep sending those early texts.
Yes, he's not joking. I think I texted you like right at 6 o'clock this morning, so
I
appreciate
so, yeah.
it. Thank
no
you,
problem.
Senator.
Thank you.
Appreciate
okay, bye-bye.
It. Bye-bye. Our social media consultant, Krista Carnes, is back on the show this morning. And Krista, thanks for being here. How are you?
I'm hanging in there. How about you?
I'm doing fine, thank you. So we had a topic yesterday that really generated a lot of responses from our audience in regards to researching articles before we post them to social media. There was something that happened last week where an article was being sent all over social media in regards to the COVID vaccine, saying that pregnant women have a higher risk of miscarriage, which is not true. The CDC says there's absolutely no proof behind that. And somebody put an article out there and it spread like wildfire all over Facebook, Twitter, you name it. So that's what kind of prompted the question. And it made me want to ask you, you know, first of all, the importance of researching and also having people really look at those sources, like what kind of should stand out to them to find out if this is good resources or if this is just fake, basically.
Excellent question. And it's so important. Like we sort of, you know, we live in the information age, but by rights, we also live in the disinformation age. And I think, you know, that's really important. It factored a lot into, you know, the election and sort of the divisiveness that we're experiencing as a culture. And first and foremost, I think a lot of the danger of it is because it's fear-based. I mean, I think when people encounter something that makes them afraid, it almost reduces their critical thinking skills, right? Like it just,
right.
You sort of act on instinct, right? So this is where you see people just instantly sharing something with just reading a headline. Headlines are often very written to be, you know, to induce an emotion, often a negative one.
Sure.
So you're sort of prone to do that anyway. But if we can keep things in check, knowing the damage that it can do, because, you know, I think the vaccine issue is definitely on a lot of levels, you know, here. People want to keep other people safe. I don't think that the intention is always to spread misinformation, although there are definitely, you know, organizations and people out there that probably, you know,
want to be trolls. Yeah, sure.
Yeah. But I mean, but by and large, we're all just trying to, you know, keep our family safe. And my mom's getting the vaccine in Florida. And should she take Advil before she goes or not? So sometimes we're researching for something, and sometimes we're seeing it come across our feed. So to analyze it, back to your question, is we have to dig into it. And if somebody says, okay, this study says, A, if it's not linked to that study, that's a big red flag. Because any reputable source of information, and that could be an organization and it could be a media outlet, you know, is going to link to whatever research they're trying to, you know, that they say they're talking about. So if there's no link, that's a red flag, and you might want to dig a little deeper on other sites. One thing, you know, we teach students, like just in research in general, if you can't find a piece of information in more than three sources, it's probably not a very reputable source.
Okay, so like just like almost like copy and paste something you'd see and maybe put it into Google, and if you don't see it popping up more than a couple of times, it's probably not accurate.
Probably not accurate, exactly. And I mean, you know, there are levels of, you know, there's a rabbit hole here for everything. So,
sure.
I mean, you might end up with some university study or something. And, you know, and you may, even just an executive summary may show you that, okay, indeed, this is
legitimate.
But you can also, if you see it mentioned in, you know, the Washington Post, the New York Times, like, you know, more reputable journalism locations, you can be much more assured, and I'm not guaranteeing, but you can be much more assured that they're fact checkers and they're, you know, that they didn't get to the point that they published without verifying that information.
Mm-hmm.
You also have to check the source of the information and to see if there's any sort of financial aspect, you know, a pharmaceutical company or, you know, a company issuing a press release, you know, is in the business of making sure that, you know, what they're putting out there makes them look good. And sometimes they will just put what makes them look good and maybe not give you the whole balanced picture.
Sure.
And, you know, good journalism is supposed to say, yes, this is this is a study that came out, but it only had X amount of participants, and most scientists believe that we'll need more research to prove that it's true. So you'll hear that when you're listening to the radio, you're reading, it's something is promising, for example, but it's not been, you know, replicated. And a lot with, science in particular is something that, you know, the reason that science becomes more and more grounded is because more and more people try to prove or disprove the same thing in a controlled setting. When it comes to politics or, you know, education, and, you know, we have so much media with us right now and available to us, it's so much as opinion, and really trying to critically listen and say, is this an opinion that may be based on a little piece of truth, or is it a big piece of truth that I'm now trying to form an opinion on? So kind of like ask yourself, what are you trying to figure out here? Because, everybody has an opinion.
And it's
not always based in
truth.
Yeah,
absolutely. No, I think that's definitely a big standout thing. I know a lot of people said, you know, look for grammar or look for spelling errors, things like that. And sometimes those are big red flags, obviously. But I think you touched on a big thing. I think when you can differentiate, like take your emotion out of it, step back and read something and go, well, that's interesting because this sentence started with I feel or I think or I know. Anything that has I in it or we or what, you know, it's coming from an opinion versus, you know, the CDC says or and I know I'm elementary dumbing this down, but it is true. If you look for those key, you know, sentences or key words, you will realize you're reading almost like an op-ed or an opinion piece versus a fact piece. And I think in a world where you're right, misinformation can run wild, you should kind of look for more of the fact versus the opinion. Krista, you actually brought up a topic with me yesterday that I thought actually resonated with our family as well. I know it's a little bit of a morbid situation, but I do think it's something that people should think about. You know, we think about wills, we think about, you know, what happens to our homes, our cars, our money, things like that. But what about our tech? For example, my grandmother passed suddenly from COVID back in November, and I actually got a call from my aunt and my uncle and then my mother, all of which were like, we can't get into her tablet. Now, luckily, I logged her into her tablet. I set her all up on her tablet 2 years ago, but they wanted to get in there to make sure they could get rid of any information, or they wanted to make sure that it was clear before they went and like donated it or something. So tell us sort of what people can do, you know, whether it's for themselves or it's to set up their parents or a family friend or anybody. Should they have a backup plan, like people who know all your passwords or something? Like, what would you suggest?
Yeah, it's really tough, and it is something I think we have to think about that our, you know, previous generations really haven't. I mean, your grandmother might be sort of a, since you set it up, you're a little bit more covered. But, you know, this was all prompted because we lost a dear family friend, and he's in his early 50s, private guy. And there was, you know, he has a laptop and social media accounts and all these things, and his family just is a little bit at a loss on how to manage it. We talk about planning. It is a little bit morbid, but I think maybe the pandemic has brought it up. And I think we have to make it a little bit a part of our estate planning, which is not a comfortable conversation. And, you know, I think after having a will and, you know, making sure that all your important documents are in one place and, you know, the name of your lawyer and the name of your accountant and all that stuff is together. And there's lots out there in terms of like planning checklists that you can do, and it doesn't require a lot of money. You can even make wills online that would, you know, cover sort of basic situations that are, you know, perfectly valid, and however you want to break it up. But I think we have to start thinking about what do we want people to know about, you know, ourselves. And in terms of the computer itself is one thing. I mean, Apple, for example, is if you don't really have the password, you really can't get in. I mean, you can send a lot of times you have to show companies proof of purchase. So if that computer was not bought with a receipt, like you don't have the receipt, they can't verify. You might have to bring a death certificate. It's a very long process. And of course, in the midst of, you know, profound grief, this is not what you want to deal with.
Right.
So, and some people just want to be extra private, and maybe you'll never get into that computer. You know, like that computer just may be locked off to you. But what you can do for things like social media accounts, which, you know, I mean, I don't know if you've ever had someone who you've lost, then, you know, their birthday has popped up in your Facebook feed, and you're like, you know, it just sort of like re-traumatizes you years later because there's...
Yeah, I actually do. So I have a very, I'm glad that you brought it up because I have a very good friend who, you know, we were friends in high school, but he was in the military. He died 6 years ago during a military accident. His Facebook is still active. You know, he would have been 31 at this point, but his Facebook's been active since he was 25, and people will still post, and it'll pop up, and like I feel bad, but I had to block him because it was just like it was this constant reminder, and I know for some people, like, oh, it's great, it's great for me to feel like I'm still close to him. For me, it was like never ending closure that just never arrived, and I've got to imagine for his sisters and his brother and his parents that it's like, oh, I wish I knew what his password was so I could deactivate him. I don't know.
Yes. So you know, Facebook and Instagram, for example, have addressed this very directly, and they now have an option to create a memorial page for someone's Facebook page or their Instagram page, and it will say remembering, you know, and then the name of your friend. It changes the settings inside so that, you know, you don't get birthday notifications and you don't get, you know, people you might want, like my cousin who pops up in my you might want to be friends with, you know, selections. And I know, and it's just algorithms, right? So they've created this option. In order to do that, even if you don't have the passwords to the account, you can submit, you can go through a process where if you have to prove your relationship, you have to, you know, send a death certificate. Sometimes even an obituary is enough if you're named in the obituary. And then they usually assign someone to manage that account. So a sister, a friend, or something can manage. And so people can post when they're thinking of that person. And that might bring love and joy or comfort to someone, but it's not in that sort of impersonal way. Mm-hmm. Platforms in Twitter, LinkedIn, and like Pinterest, which are much more like personally driven, right? Like it's not where people usually they share their own opinions or their own career highlights or things like that. Those platforms will allow you to delete those accounts if you don't have the password. Mm-hmm. But by and large, it's easiest if you can provide, you know, if you have any sense of anything that, you know, you can have a list in your files or your, you know, in your paperwork of your firebox or whatever, that, you know, that is up to date. So you can make things easier on someone. But if you're not comfortable with that, you know, that's okay. But I do think families of those, you know, surviving need to address something, because otherwise you do have some potential of being hacked. People are unscrupulous in terms of, you know, combing obituaries and finding people's names. Like you don't want to just ignore it.
No.
And so, you know, and sometimes you just find someone who's savvy to help you go through it. Mm-hmm. But leaving that in Facebook also, just to note, you can actually pre-choose a legacy contact.
Oh,
so,
cool.
So in the event that something happens to you, that person would like not have, like they would automatically have sort of the access that you need.
Oh, wow. Okay.
To create the memorial page. Yeah. I did a little research this morning because I want to make sure that everything's up to date because things change a lot. But there are checklists out there and information on what you need to provide. I thought another good tip I saw was somebody said, you know, don't go digging. You know, for your own peace of mind, you know, you don't need to look at all the messages and the direct messages and the search histories and, you know, do yourself a favor, love who you love and, you know, take care of it. But it's, you don't want to go looking for something.
Yeah.
You know, that you don't want to find, like,
exactly.
And not that, you know, and that's just more of just a, you know, save your heart. Right.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
So,
self-care.
But I just think, you know, especially for those of us in our mid-40s, early 50s, you know, mid-50s and whatnot, like things happen and that's, this family was caught unaware. And I just thought it was, you know, especially with everything that's on our minds right now, like it just can't hurt to create a little bit of an easier path.
I agree.
People.
Yeah, I think having that backup plan and just being aware of it, you know, we have to have the uncomfortable conversations anyways, like where's your plot going to go? So you might as well throw in there, all right, who's going to take over your social media and everything. So I appreciate it, Krista. Thank you for bringing that to our attention. And if anyone wants to get in touch with you, how do they find you?
Find me on Twitter at Krista Carnes, or you can even email me, Krista@KristaCarnes.com too.
All right, Krista, always a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much, and we'll talk
to you
again,
Melissa,
in a couple weeks. All right.
All right. Good.
Krista.
Take care.
Thanks. You too. We are going to Shelton this morning, where Mayor Mark Loretti is. And good morning, Mayor. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. And good morning to you.
So Couple things. We had an announcement from the governor yesterday in regards to the rollout for the vaccine. It's looking like it's going to be age-based, basically, unless you're a teacher or a child care provider. It's going to go age bracket by age bracket. What do you think about that?
Well, look, these things are never easy decisions to make because everyone likes to think that they're a priority and that they're first, and it's not possible for everybody to be first. So my feeling is that you take the most vulnerable in your population, and that's what you do. Look, the other thing, too, is that there's not enough supply. The supply, I mean, you look at the national news, and every governor and every mayor around the country is complaining we're running out of the vaccine. We can't institute it fast enough. And they're right. So, you know, people have to understand that.
Sure. But, you know, when we talk about the most vulnerable population, wouldn't that include people with underlying health conditions? Like if you're a cancer patient? Like, why aren't they included?
It's a good point. Yeah. So, you know, if you go age-based, you know, we know that the elderly are the most afflicted in our population. So, I mean, I think that makes some sense. And then people have underlying conditions. Should be included in the mix, and you know, maybe their doctors should verify that.
Mm-hmm. Now, what were kind of your thoughts, Mayor Loretti, when we talk a little bit about like the stimulus package? What are some things that you're sort of focused on? It sounds like our lawmakers on the national level in Washington, D.C., it sounds like they're going to pass something hopefully this week where we could roll it out by the middle to March would be nice.
Well, the biggest problem for people at the local level, like myself, is clarity in the purpose for what it was designated for. You know, they say, okay, Shelton, you're going to get $2 million of stimulus money, but it's very vague as to how you can spend it and the things that you can spend it on. And I think every municipality goes through that. So, you know, and then you wait months and months and months for some type of definition to come down from people at the staff level. You know, people who are legislators are many times disconnected from what goes on in the real world and the life of what a mayor or first selectman has to do to implement, you know, things like public safety and protect the well-being of its citizens. It's you know, I've always just shaken my head over things like this.
Well, sure. I mean, especially like, you know, Shelton, I think the unfortunate glaring example of where you're in sort of a bind, Mayor, is like what happened at the Plum Memorial Library. Now, that is back open, but you had the director who was hospitalized for COVID, a custodian who was a longtime, you know, worker there passed away from COVID. Many people were infected. And, you know, you have to kind of balance that and figure out how do you reopen that safely? How do you make people feel comfortable? How do you protect your staff members there? And that's just the library, you know, in the whole city of Shelton. You're talking about one place in comparison to many other outlets where COVID could kind of creep up.
Yeah, this is really, it's a moving target. And there's it's amazing to me how it just affects everybody differently. Mm-hmm. And you know, you just have to be prepared to respond. And look, and nobody has a crystal ball, even though some of your critics, you know, think that they have one. So you deal with these things as it evolves and as it develops.
Sure. Talking to Mayor Mark Loretti this morning out of Shelton. You know, Mayor Loretti, as we talk about kind of the stimulus money and how you're saying, okay, so let's say Shelton gets allotted $2 million and then it's months later where you determine where that money is actually going to go. At this point, where would you say the most need is in Shelton? Would you say it's making your schools safer? Would you say it's public transportation? Like, where do you feel when we get stimulus money, Shelton really needs it?
Well, some of that is dependent upon the regulations and the guidance you get from CDC.
Sure.
It's not what we think. I like to think that our schools are pretty clean, they're pretty safe, that we take good precautions. But some of the regulations that get passed along with this are unreasonable and really defy logic at times. I mean, you can't – I'll give you a quick example. You know, this past summer, we never opened up our playgrounds.
Right.
We never opened them up because I wasn't going to put myself – or our employees in a position to fail because they would, things that they asked us to do, like wipe down playground equipment once every hour. I mean, think about that. They wanted us to take temperatures of kids when they got there and when they left. I mean, that's not what the role of our service is supposed to be. These are our health precautionary measures. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I just sometimes it's just not worth it for mm-hmm. the things that they want you to do. It's easy to sit up in Hartford or Washington and pass judgment and tell you to go do it. It's a different story to do it.
Well, and I also think, too, you're looking at demand. You know, are you really going to, first of all, it's not like money is flowing freely anywhere right now. So do you pay someone to just stand around and wait and just do temperature checks? And then, like, what if people don't go to the park that day? So I think you also have to kind of weigh those things, too. Like, where's the demand? What's the need? Like, do people need to use a playground versus in the dead of the summer, do they need to use a pool? You know, I think those are things that those are hard decisions that you got to make.
Yeah, and these are things that get legislated down to the local level, and they don't care about money. I think it's pretty obvious. You know, they leave that up to us to be able to deal with. You know, they pass the regulations. Oftentimes, the money doesn't follow it. And you know, okay, yeah, you know, we a lot of times we just fend for ourselves.
Is there something in particular you're kind of like insinuating? Like, was there legislation or anything where it kind of like? Where it sort of got you into a place where you're like, wow, I got to figure this out?
Well, education is a classic example of it. Mm-hmm. You know, the legislation that they mandate, things that they mandate for education, first of all, no one can follow all the mandates.
Mm-hmm.
And I would love to talk to these legislators about some of these, the price associated with complying with some of the mandates that, listen, are just arbitrary.
Mm-hmm.
And affect people differently. And so, you know, when you look at the debt that we're racking up in Washington, you know, who's gonna deal with this in the future? Not the people who are sitting there today, and there'll be no accountability for it.
No, it's gonna be our kids, sure.
Kids, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they have no idea what's coming. And well, so, you know, I worry about things like that. Mm-hmm. You know, they wanna give money to people who don't need it. There are many of us in society who don't need that help. There are many of us who have gone to work every day and have gotten our paychecks who don't need the stimulus money.
Right.
Let's help the people that need to be helped.
I agree with
that. That's who we are as Americans.
Mm-hmm.
I'm all for that.
Yeah. No, you make a lot of the very similar points that I've made as well, Mayor Loretti. I appreciate it. And I know we'll talk again in a couple of weeks. Unfortunately, we've run out of time. But thank you so much for coming on this morning. I always appreciate talking to you.
Likewise. You take care.
All right. You too.